Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. How are you doing today on this very lovely, hot, humid July 16th, 2013? I'm actually back. I don't know if you missed me, but for a couple of weeks, I was not doing the program, and I missed it. So now here I am. I'm back, and I wanted to tell you a little story. So yesterday, I was finishing up on filming a food show for Responsible Eating and Living, my nonprofit, responsibleeatingandliving.com. And actually, we're introducing into our food shows the Swingin' Gourmets. You may have heard about the Swingin' Gourmets before, swingingourmets.com. And I was running some errands before finishing up the filming, and I was in my neighborhood in Forest Hills walking down Queens Boulevard. Queens Boulevard, you may know, is called the Boulevard of Death or the Boulevard of Broken Bones because there have been so many accidents down this street. And I'm crossing the street, and there's a whole bunch of cars going through a red light trying to get through as pedestrians are trying to go because they have actually the right of way. And there's one last car passing through as I'm crossing, and I'm behind a literal little old lady. She's got a floppy hat on, and she's walking with a cane, and I'm walking behind her. And this car is about to hit us, and so I put my thumb and forefinger together, and I blow a big, piercing, loud whistle. And the guy stops, and we get to pass. And I was thinking to myself during that time, like, I know that I'm not really making a difference here by blowing the whistle, but it makes me feel a little better. And I'm thinking maybe the driver will wake up just for that moment and notice there are people walking in front of him, and maybe he'll connect the dots somehow. Anyway, we made it to the other side, and I could tell that the old woman was a little irked. And we started having this conversation, and I told her, you know, can you believe how inconsiderate all these drivers are? And she said, all empires, all great empires fall, and ours is on the way down. And I thought, okay, she's seen a lot. But then she changed her tone and she said, but there are many people on this planet who make it all worthwhile, the heroes that are doing good and making a difference, and all of those animal rights activists, I love them. And then I took a double take and looked at her. What did you say, animal rights activist? I said, that's me. I'm a vegan. I'm an animal rights activist. And then I loved her. She was just this wonderful woman who was just slowly marching down the street, getting from one place to another. And we had a really lovely conversation until we made it to the next intersection. And there was another driver who was trying to make a left turn, looking left. We were on his right. He was rolling. He was not paying any attention to us. And sure enough, I whistled again and he stopped. And I kind of glared at him and he shrugs. And then he's angry. He's angry at me for stopping so that I didn't get killed with this woman. Anyway, it was kind of crazy. But in the end, after talking to this woman and she was telling me how grateful she was for the people that were doing the trap, neuter, and release, and people that take in pets, take in animals, and take care of them as foster parents for a while until they get permanent homes. And the woman that was taking her cat to the vet that day because she was too frail to do so, she was so grateful for those people. And as I continued in the hot and humid atmosphere, wondering, as I always do, why I do what I do, I felt inspiration to keep going from this person who showed some appreciation and wisdom. Anyway, so on that note, I thought we would lead into what we're going to talk about today with my wonderful guest, Martin Rowe, who is the co-founder of Lantern Books. He's the author of, how do you pronounce that?
Go ahead.
Yeah. I never knew. I've read it, and I don't even know how to say it. Nicaea. Nicaea. A Book of Correspondences, Bertie Wooster and the Lizard King, and co-author of Right Off the Bat, Baseball, Cricket, Literature, and Life. He edited the collection The Way of Compassion and co-founded the monthly magazine Satcha. More of Martin's published writings can be found at martin-rowe.com. And he's got Martin's random reviews and thoughts on cricket at Right Off the Bat. And you could find links to that on the Responsible Eating and Living website. And welcome.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining me here in the studio, Martin.
It's a pleasure. It's nice and cool in here.
It could be cooler. But I'm not complaining. Anyway, so you've written this book, The Polar Bear in the Zoo, a speculation And it is indeed a speculation. And very interesting, because you're talking about one photograph and several other photographs of animals and how we perceive them and how others perceive them, how the animals perceive their situation in that moment, and how our perspective is affected by the box around that picture or the frame, and all frames, the way we see things. Framing. Where did you get this concept to, as a point of reference to start your story about frames?
Well, the particular photograph that I'm interested in, the polar bear in the zoo, is a very framed photograph. It's in black and white, and the left-hand side of the photograph is fully black, and the right-hand side of the photograph is the image of a polar bear, which is in a glass tank through which light streams onto the huddled forms of six small children, and right down the middle of the photograph is a big, thick wooden frame. So the picture is in of itself an expression of this very dichotomous existence, dark and light, black and white, and of animal and human. So for me, it was very interesting to see a photograph that played so much with this literal frame. And the frame of the photograph, of course, encapsulates the certain way that we look at animals, especially in zoos, where we're on one side and they're on another side. So there's a frame which is, could be a moat, or it could be a fence, or in some ways a distancing medium. So that obviously put me in mind not only of the frame in the zoo and the photograph, but also of the capture of the image and the capture of the animal. And the reverse of that, the exposure of the animal and the expose of the photograph, with all of the sort of scandalous surreptitiousness that the word expose has to it.
Did you find this photo and decide you had to write this, or were you thinking about writing something like this and found the photo?
No, it was very much the photo. I'd wanted to write something about our relationship with animals, particularly involving critical theory and some continental philosophy. And I've been looking for something, some way of inspiring me to write in this vein. And this photo arrested me. It stopped me and said, concentrate on me. And it really was very, very compelling and made me really try and investigate this one photograph to see what it could reveal to me.
Well, I really enjoyed reading your explanation of it and all the thoughts around it, as long along with the other pictures that you mentioned in the book. And what I think of is how we're in this society of sound bites, and just everything is fast. And to take the time, just look at one picture, not even many. I know that when I go to the Louvre, for example, in Paris or other large museums, I'm overwhelmed. There's just too much information. But to spend time and really think about, you could learn so much from any one image. But most people don't want to invest that.
Sure. I think I wanted to go deeply into the image to show that one can investigate something from multiple perspectives and bring in a lot of other detail from other pictures, but to focus it, and again, there's the visual metaphor, to focus on one particular image and the set of tropes and ideas that that image reveals to you. I remember going to the Louvre myself, and everybody, of course, was clustered
at the Mona Lisa.
At the Mona Lisa, and then the next door room was a magnificent picture of San Sebastian, the Martyr of San Sebastian, by Georges de la Tour, who uses light in a very, very evocative and interesting way. And nobody was looking at that photograph, that painting. And I stood there all that time, and I've never forgotten that painting. It's a very, very vivid and evocative work. And so for me, the opportunity to concentrate without anybody in front of you and without anybody demanding that you say, this image is valuable, and figure out why it is valuable, instead say, this image speaks to me, why does it speak to me, is much more significant, I think.
Well, now we're coming from a foundation of being aware of all the animal exploitation that goes on, the violence in the world, and both of us as individuals trying to do what we can to help the world see and respond in a more positive way. You, as a co-founder of Lantern Books, amongst many other products you've been projects you've been involved with have enabled many authors to write books about issues affecting animal exploitation. We're both vegan. And so I see this book as another way to get people to focus on some of the issues and things that we really take for granted, especially in zoos or pictures of animals where we don't even see the pain, the suffering that we, many of us, I'm sure, just put our own images and thoughts and not even realize what's going on in the image. And so it was somewhat eye-opening to read your interpretations of all of the pictures, to think about what we take for granted very often.
Right. The photograph is about coming face-to-face with the animal. But because you're looking through a glass into the animal's enclosure, at least partly, when one looks into the face of the animal through the glass reflects back oneself. So the animal is not only looking at you and demanding attention from you, but you are yourself holding up a mirror to yourself. So there is, this is why it's called a speculation. The speculation, of course, the word speculum means mirror in Latin. So you've got a strong sense of looking through into something that you hope will reveal some truth to you, but also a recognition that at least partly you are looking back at yourself, which could lead you to reflect, literally, on yourself and hopefully gain some insight. But on the other hand, might be a way of validating your own perspective as opposed to honestly accepting the look of the animal as it looks directly at you.
It's really a crazy thing that we have zoos. It's just one of many crazy things that humans do. We have invented many crazy things. And, you know, why do we need zoos? It's all part of this power trip, I guess, we're on, where we feel superior and want to believe that animals don't have the same needs that we do. And they do we care that they mind being away from their family and friends? Do we care that they're living in a cage or in an unnatural environment? I don't really know. I know that it's a fun place for families to bring their kids. And what are the kids learning subliminally by seeing all this?
Well, the zoo, as I say in the book, actually, the zoo began as a way for powerful kings and potentates to gather together animals from around the world in a way that expressed their control over the natural world and the peoples who lived in those countries. So it was a political as well as an expression of political as well as geographical control. And then zoos became places to see and be seen by people walking through, and a place where the city itself could express its civilization. And then ultimately it becomes a place where animals are displayed as in a gallery. And several of the photographs that I have in the book show the very highly decorated entablatures and scenes that you see. So it's actually a theater. It's a gallery. Mm-hmm. It's a visual way of displaying the art of the animals. So these are static tableau vivant of creatures there for our edification and entertainment. So in that regard, they serve a very particular purpose, which is to be a live museum of modern art.
And they're not part of any Actors' Equity Union performing.
Yeah, they don't get any union dues. No.
Or benefits. Yeah, no. Unfortunate. I'm just thinking back to when I was really young. My parents took my... I don't think I was around, actually. I just heard this story. My parents took my sister to the zoo, took her little red coat, and left it on the fence between them and the elephant. And the elephant picked up that coat and swung it around and put it to shreds. I'm not exactly sure what that elephant was trying to tell them, but I'm glad he had an opportunity to do that.
It's probably some stimulation, some of the only stimulation
yeah.
he received all day.
Yeah, actually, I think that's probably it. Oh, here's something new.
Yeah.
Gosh. All right, so here it is. We are doing what we can in this world as vegans, and there's this thread throughout the book about why we do what we do and does it make a difference? And you kind of come to the end, and I don't want to give any spoiler alerts here, but there is no answer why we do what we do. you do what you do because...
Well, I talk about my evolution as an animal activist, which was a surprise to me since there was no clear conversion experience. There was no one moment when I realized that everything had to change. And yet, when animal activists talk about their work, they talk in the language of conversion, the religious experience, mm-hmm. the moment, or the idea that, again, using a visual metaphor, you know, they were blind, but now they see. That which was completely unknowing to them becomes massively self-evident to them, and they can't understand why nobody else sees it, which is an essentially religious narrative. So I wanted to explore that and to try and present what I think of as an existential mode of activism, whereby the concept that one would create a vegan world is recognized for the impossible, almost absurd goal. And yet, because it is absurd, not in spite of it being absurd, but because it is absurd, one does it anyway. That one puts aside specific goals or notions of success and progress and accepts that one is seeking the ultimately impossible task and yet continues to do it. So it is, in that regard, a kind of a fundamentally existential activity.
I think I love that, and I think we need to talk more about that. We have many different animal activists out there, and they all have different approaches. Some are more successful than others. Some really piss people off, and then a lot of people burn out. And if we really understood that we're doing it because it's what we do, period. There's no reason other than it's right. It's right for us as individuals. We can't really know or believe that in the long term, in our lifetime or another lifetime, things are going to be the way we want them to be.
Right. I think you need to get out of the way of your own aspirations and let the aspiration itself and the activity itself speak to the person or persons you're trying to reach. I think many times those people who are trying to convince you of their passion allow their passion to get in the way of your response to their information and their passion. If you allow them to feel themselves an agent in their own change, they will do it. And that will be the ultimate success. You may not see it, you may not feel responsible for it, but if you continually hammer away at somebody demanding that they change, they will put up resistance. We just published a book by Nick Cooney at Lantern Books called Change of Heart, which essentially argues that case, that too many times those who wish to bring about social change allow themselves to get in the way of their own mm-hmm. message by not being responsive to the way people receive information and receive information that changes them internally, and then they process that information in their own way.
Well, as this message becomes more popular, this vegan message, animal rights, how our food choices affect health and environment and treatment of animals, it's becoming more popular thanks to the internet, I think, primarily. There's a portion of it where it's trendy and people are more interested in it because there are celebrities that are involved. There's a lot of and there are some activists that are getting more notoriety than others, not necessarily because of the work that they do, but just because of the way of the world. And some people have fame and some people are just working hard all the time without much without much acknowledgement. But I think what you're telling us is kind of a message not just for activism, but for all life, that we can't really control anything.
Right. In the end, to go back to the polar bear in the zoo, and what is demanded of the polar bear in the zoo is that you approach the window and the animal presents him or herself before you, and it is up to you to determine how you best respond or most appropriately respond to that demand, which is a demand that the animal has towards you, which is recognize me, see me. And that seeing means that you can do two things. You can return that look, and the return of that look could be a threat, but it could be an acknowledgement of some fellow feeling, or you could turn away. And that turning away could be an ignoring of that animal, or a turning away because it is too painful to acknowledge your own complicity in that animal's demand that you acknowledge their presence on this planet. So I think really all animal activists can do at the heart of their work is to present the information in such a way that the individual is compelled through their own desire to see, to face the animal, and to respond to the animal's question.
Yeah, well, anytime I have an opportunity to interact with an animal, now I haven't been to a zoo in a very long time, but I have been out in Costa Rica, for example, where there are cows walking around and any other animal that I might bump into. I really love to look at them as much as I possibly can without thinking I'm going to put myself in any kind of crazy danger. But there is so much in any being's eyes. We don't speak the same languages, but there is this look at me, like you said, see me, acknowledge me.
Right. The seeing can also be in a slab of meat. I mean, the point being that you look at the slab of meat, and instead of seeing the meat, you see the animal. And the animal once looked, and the animal is still demanding that question of you. The question is, do you see the being that was there before the being was unbeinged, was turned into a thing instead of an individual?
There was that other picture of the hawk. I think it was just the head. What an incredible photograph.
I should say these photographs are all taken by a Canadian photojournalist called Joanne MacArthur, who has a book coming out from us later on in the year called We Animals, and is the subject of a magnificent documentary film by the Canadian filmmaker Liz Marshall called The Ghosts in Our Machine. And the wonderful thing about Joanne is that she is an incredibly perspicacious photographer. She really allows you to gain perspective, and she provides perspective in her photographs by placing human beings within the frame, or in this case, the one you're mentioning, of disturbing our notions of what the look means, because there you see this incredibly strong and vivid look from the right eye of a red-tailed hawk, and only after a millisecond do you realize that the hawk's head is all that exists of the hawk. It's sitting on a table in a vivisection laboratory. So one is constantly aware of the liveliness behind the eye of the hawk, only to realize that you are the one who is doing the animating, because the hawk is dead. So it's a really very striking and strong photograph. She does that. She forces you to shift the way you look and the way you see what is presented before you in a way to develop discernment and insight.
Yeah, that look and that bird's eye is very alive, but I guess it's me making it, well.
Once you make it alive, you're therefore responsible. You are a Frankenstein. You are responsible for the life of that creature.
But part of it might be just the fact that, you know, we have all kinds of crazy movies these days with all kinds of graphic arts where heads talk that have no bodies, and there's all that crazy cartoon stuff that goes on. But
right. Well, that comes from the myth of Frankenstein, which, of course, was an early 19th century response to the new science of vivisection. It was a new way of looking at nature, which many people felt was deeply problematic and blasphemous towards how one should relate to the natural world, instead of putting it on a slab and cutting it up in order to understand how nature works. Others, including Mary Shelley, felt that one should sort of honor the rhythms and natural systems intact and not bring them into a lab and cut them up. So this head represents that. And Frankenstein's monster is an example of the disembodied body sewn together from cadavers and given life by human beings only for it to express itself as a vegetarian, caring being who seeks to find his place amongst the natural environment and is then destroyed because of it.
Yeah, that I don't think most people know that story.
Carol Adams, The Sexual Politics of Meat, she has a whole chapter on Frankenstein's monster. I would suggest people check it out.
Yes, another wonderful lantern book.
Not yet. Not one of ours, but she's a lantern author.
Oh, so. Lantern author, not a lantern book. Okay.
Bloomsbury published it.
Oh, still very good and groundbreaking for its time. And we talked about The Defiant Daughters a while back and had Carol on the show. Yes, another great, that's a great lantern book.
Yes.
And there are
many. I think so, too.
Many, many are. All right. So we just have a very few minutes left. Who is this book for?
This book is directed towards people who are interested in photography. It's also people who are interested in philosophy and social studies. It's got a bit of theology in there as well. I hope that it will be picked up by university students, both as supplementary reading to their work on human-animal studies, if they're in that discipline, or also as primary reading, whereby they can then exert their disciplinary understanding to that particular to that book. So it's one of the first of a series of books in a series I'm calling biographies. Which I want people to examine one particular species in one particular frame and go deep rather than broadly into the subject. And the next one coming along is called The Elephants in the Room, an excavation, which is about two Kenyan conservationists, elephants, and the American Museum of Natural History. So that's coming out in September. So you'll see the series developing from then.
Okay. That sounds... Well, I'm going to read that one next.
Excellent.
Okay. All right. Well, we definitely do see different things when we look in closely at something, and then when we pull away and see a much, much broader view. And when we pull away and see... Again, you know, depends on who we are. Our perspective is going to be different. But when I pull away and I see, as we go further back, and we see the globe, we see our solar system, the universe, etc., we can make many different interpretations. But when we look in close, we see the individual stories, and those are the ones that really speak to us and where we can understand. We kind of get numb when we pull back, I think, and we see thousands and thousands. When we talk about the numbers, like 60 billion land animals a year are killed for food, and you know, so many millions of this and that, and the numbers are just overwhelming. And when we look at individuals, just like when people go to a puppy mill or something, I mean, a puppy store, not a puppy mill, but they're from puppy mills. That's what I'm thinking. And we find the incredible cuteness or something in one of these particular animals, and we want to have one. We relate definitely on an individual level, and that might make us react in one way or another. It might make us want to take the puppy home. It might make us want to understand something more about that animal. I don't know.
Right. Well, I'm a great believer in small picture thinking. There's a lot of big picture thinking, and many of the manuscripts I've received are all about the entire cosmos and the history of animal exploitation for tens of thousands of years, and there's a place for that. But I think to go deep and particular not only is very revealing generally and allows people to indeed to focus on one particular creature and understand that animal, but it also allows you to, you know, tell a deeper and more individual story that can transform somebody.
The big picture is numbing. The big picture makes you think you really can't make a difference. There's really no point in doing anything, being that one drop in this very, very, very large bucket that's never going to get filled up. But when you focus in on something, it has individual meaning and can make a difference to you or anyone who's sharing that moment with you.
Sure.
Well, I enjoyed reading The Polar Bear in the Zoo, A Speculation. And anyone who is looking to dig anyone who is questioning where they want to go with their diet or their lifestyle or their look into life, this is a good starting point for thinking about things. So there you have it. Okay, and read every other book that Lantern has published, and that's just my assignment for today.
Thank you. Not a difficult task. There are only 170 of them.
Only 170. Look at that. Okay, well, thank you for joining me, Martin, and thank you for everything that you're doing for this planet. Everything absurd and meaningful.
Thank you.
Let's take a break. Hello. We are back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you. So I hope you enjoyed that last half hour I did. Sometimes I like to mix it up a little bit and get a little philosophical, a little food for thought there, things to digest that you don't normally think about. And now we're going to talk about nutrition because people can't ever get enough of it, I think. At least people are always asking me questions. So I'm going to bring on my next guest, Dr. Michael Wald, a.k.a. the Blood Detective. He is the Director of Nutrition at Integrated Medicine of Mount Kisco, PC. Dr. Wald has appeared numerous times on Fox 5 News, Channel 11 PIX, Channel 12 Westchester News, and ABC World News Tonight with Diane Sawyer. He is a double board certified in nutrition, is a certified dietitian nutritionist, a certified nutritional specialist, and a certified clinical nutritionist. He holds a postgraduate degree in chiropractic from the Los Angeles College of Chiropractic, a master's degree from the University of Bridgeport, and he earned an MD degree from the University of Health Sciences School of Medicine, Antigua, and was past director of education for the International and American Association of Clinical Nutritionists, the largest nutrition organization in the United States. He's published over a dozen books, writes regular health articles, lectures across the U.S. and internationally, and has developed the Blood Detective software program that allows him to interpret massive amounts of blood lab results, finding problems and creating healing solutions for his patients. He has also developed a nutritional product line that is being used nationally by healthcare providers and the public. His newest books, due for publication in 2013, are entitled The Blood Detective's Longevity Secrets, Frankenfoods, Genetically Modified Foods, Your Questions Answered, and A Glutenaholic, How to Live Well Without Gluten. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Wald.
Hi, it seems like it's all about my bio. I apologize about that.
What do you mean?
It's pretty long.
Oh, no, it's good. I like people to know who I'm talking to and, you know, just give a quick taste before we jump into the details.
That's great.
I like to know more about who I'm talking to. So I think
sure.
It was all, it's all good, as I always say. It's all good.
Okay,
so the thing is, for a very long time, most medical doctors have known very little about nutrition. And that has led us down, I could even say, a deadly path, almost, in some instances. It's so important for those of us who are interested in health and for those who are interested in healing to include nutrition as one of those tools. And it looks like you've done your job and learned a lot about nutrition.
I've done my best over time, there's no doubt about it. I think the point to make here is that everyone needs to be concerned about nutrition, and the latest information on genetically modified foods changes the whole landscape of food and nutrition, you know, upside down.
Well, that's interesting, and I want to hear a lot more about it, because a lot of times when we talk about genetically modified food, we don't talk about the health aspect. We talk about what it maybe may or may not be doing to the environment, but there's so little information. The companies that promote genetically modified foods haven't really done the testing on humans, especially, so we don't really know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that point that you bring up, that there really has not been any or not much human testing, particularly any long-term studies, you say as a matter of fact, but that's a point that seems to be completely ignored by, I think, the companies that produce genetically modified seeds, such as Monsanto, and also the FDA and other geneticists and scientists that seem to be just perfectly fine with using the United States population and the world at large as the testing ground before careful, specific scientific studies been done. So you're absolutely right. I don't think the study's been there, which I suppose that makes me of the position that I do not believe personally that a person should be consuming genetically modified foods, at least not until a proper study's been done.
Now,
if you'd like, yes, go ahead.
I agree with you, but I've heard many of the arguments, and one of the arguments is there's this gray area where foods have been hybridized or changed at the genetic level, not genetically modified in the engineered term that we use today, but have been modified genetically over time through nature, through a variety of different techniques over hundreds of years. And we may or may not be suffering from some of that. Those foods were never tested, and some of them we've adapted to, some of them maybe we haven't, and we might be seeing some repercussions from that. But a lot of the scientists say that we've been eating foods that have been morphed in one way or another for many, many years. Why would genetically modified foods be considered any different?
Yeah, that's great, the way that you put that question. And that was a question that I was asked on Fox News recently as well. And I think this is the answer in a nutshell, is that the production of genetically modified foods, the whole science behind producing those foods, is not anything whatsoever like natural selection, which is basically what you meant, where we have nature through a period of time, and we have various foods reacting to the environment. Some of them live, some of them don't, some of them have their genetic materials altered to adapt to the environment, and that's what's called natural selection, which occurs over the course of hundreds of thousands or millions of years since the beginning of of time, that where plants and foods were available on this planet. So the big controversy, at least as it's put out there, is that then how could genetically modified foods in a laboratory be any different? Well, a couple of reasons, I think. Number one, in nature, we don't have salmon, for example, having sex with tomatoes, or so we just don't have that kind of that wouldn't happen in natural selection. So we're producing DNA strains and foods that are unlike anything we've adapted to or have had the opportunity to slowly adapt to or over the course of evolution. But even that doesn't necessarily make it bad, I'll admit. But there's another point. The method, one of the methods used to genetically modified foods, to produce GMO foods, as they're called, is using a gene gun, which is known as the ballistic method, where basically genes are blasted into DNA. So, for example, if scientists want, and I'm making this up completely, but if scientists want, let's say, tomatoes to have more resistance to frost, they might blast those tomatoes with salmon genes, because cold water fish do well in cold, and they blast these desired genes into the food, in this case the tomato, and they hope that those genetic characteristics that they want actually show up, and they change the sequence of the genes. Now, here's something you don't hear too much about potential dangers, which simply have not been proven or disproven in either way, but we know they could theoretically happen, is when you blast these genes into a DNA sequence, that's our genetics, you change the entire sequence of the genetic code. So let's say you're adding two genes, which is a common number of genes they might add, let's say, from the salmon to the tomato. If you have a sequence of blocks, if you can visualize that in your mind in a row, but you add two more blocks, everything else is altered in sequence because of those simple, small insertions. And that can change how the DNA of that food, let's say in this case the tomato, expresses. So genes in humans or in plants, they express certain traits. And if you overexpress certain DNA and genes, that is what causes many kinds of cancer. And if you underexpress certain genes, that can create other health problems. And these sorts of over and underexpression of genes, which can result from these haphazard methods of genetic modification, are known to sometimes produce these completely unpredictable side effects. So that's one concern. I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that before I continue.
Please continue.
Yeah, and in addition to that, we have, to use a real-life example, we have corn. Most of the corn, not all, but most of the corn in the United States is what's called BT corn, which basically means it's a pesticide factory. Corn literally produces pesticide. So any corn that anyone eats here that is not GMO-free or organic with quotations around it is consuming corn that has been genetically modified to be a drug factory. Now, the problem with that is pesticides are potentially toxic, and the proper study has simply not been done to suggest that the amount of consumption that the average human being consumes in terms of corn, whether or not that's safe in the long term. There's been a few animal studies and a couple of human studies that suggest concern. They're not definitive by any means, but they certainly open up the question of more study to be done. But unfortunately, those days are over as far as GM corn is concerned, genetically modified corn. The corn is out there, and once you put these foods out there, particularly corn, which is involved in pollination and cross-pollination, you can't take that out of the environment. That's finished.
Yeah, it's a very sad situation. Now, the thing is, you probably know, when I read your bio, you've got this program to interpret massive amounts of blood lab results. And the part of the problem is people have a myriad of health problems these days, and it can be really difficult to target what is the cause, and many times it's not even one thing that's the cause. There's lots of things that are problematic. So I imagine it would be really hard to test whether genetically modified foods are problematic or not.
Again, that's a very accurate statement. And let's assume for a minute that it certainly is problematic. No one is arguing with that. Not impossible, but problematic. And even if it was problematic, which I believe it is, that certainly, of course, doesn't mean we don't want to make attempts at for public safety reasons to do proper study, particularly when there have been some studies in humans that show potential issues. Now, when we look at genetically modified foods, we've been consuming them in one form or another for about 15 years, and there was geneticist who criticized what's known as the French study on genetically modified foods, which showed all these problems in these animals.
I remember. I was so excited when that came out.
and as you know, there was, again, one individual who said, well, listen, if we've been consuming these foods for 10 or 15 years, why aren't we dropping like flies? Mm. And when I was asked this question on Fox recently, I said, well, we are. Yeah. The incidence of chronic degenerative diseases are on the rise. The so-called infectious diseases and food poisoning incidents have increased. Maybe it's not food poisoning. Maybe it's GMO foods. Mm. We just do not know. But because of an increased incidence of a variety of different cancers, diabetes, et cetera, it cannot be ruled out that the cause of that is not some ingredient in our diet that we're all eating all the time and have been for about a decade or more, which fits exactly with the introduction of GMO foods.
Okay, so here's the real sad part, okay? The main reason we have GMO foods is because it's a product that can be sold and can be patented and can be profited from. And if these companies that were producing genetically modified food really were altruistic and really meant what they say to the public, how they want to feed the hungry and how they want to create enough food for the growing population all around the world, they would be investing in very different techniques in distribution and in farming techniques and in getting the water to the crops and fertilizing the soil. But instead, genetically modified foods encourage us to use the worst possible agricultural techniques, monocropping and using pesticides and herbicides. And, you know, if anybody really looked into what this was all about, it's all about profit, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think your point is well taken. And there's another simpler issue, I think, too, and that is, and you said it, food distribution, there are many many of the sites like Stop Hunger Now, for example, one of the bigger organizations committed to resolving the hunger crisis on the planet, even they say on their own website that it is not a shortage of food that is the cause of world hunger. It's the problems with distribution of the food. They estimate that the average individual on the planet, there's 4.5 pounds of food already for them. So the pro-GMO people are taking, I think, an unethical sort of stance by claiming that those that are against genetically modified foods somehow don't want to help solve world hunger because genetically modified foods, they claim, this is a whole other conversation, will increase the yield and help world hunger when it's not an issue with a lack of food but distribution of food. So I think when I hear arguments like that, and I want to be open-minded and not biased to this this whole situation, but when I hear untruths like that, it certainly brings up some doubt in my mind. You know, a couple of months ago when I was researching for my book on Frankenfoods, genetically modified foods, I watched quite a lot of videos, and I happened to come across a Dr. Oz video show where he was interviewing a woman from Monsanto, or a geneticist, I believe, from Monsanto, and he asked her, well, what about the concerns of safety and cancer in humans and the need for more study? And I knew in a moment after she gave her answer that there was really an ethical problem here that I suspected before, but it just really hit me home when she said, we do not need any more studies. Human beings have been eating this food, and the process of the genetic modification of food is identical and equivalent, and she may not have said identical, but she said equivalent to natural selection of foods, which any respectable geneticist knows is completely untrue.
Yes.
So when you hear that, plus, this is, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but this was something I'd never seen before. On that same show, or it may have been a different show, there were two individuals that are, one of them is the author of Seeds of Deception, one of the better books out there on genetically modified food.
Jeffrey Smith.
Yeah, exactly. They had that gentleman and someone else on the stage, and they said, you know, we're going to do something on the show we've never done before. We're going to interview these two gentlemen, and then we're going to have them leave the stage, and then we're going to have the representative from Monsanto come on the stage. It amazes me, and as you know, having done media, that what happened is Oz wanted some ratings, and he called these people up, and then the powers that be at Monsanto said, listen, we're not going first. We want to go second.
Mm-hmm.
And they insisted on separating them like children in a playground that we're fighting, which is really sad to me when we can't get to the issues and we have to play those kinds of games. The individuals that were against the GMO were very well-spoken and I think 100% accurate in the issues that they brought up. And then some of the concerns that I had, I just let you know of some of the statements made by the Monsanto person were just shocking to me. That was the turning point in my thinking that there's a lot more to this issue than meets the eye.
Now, what we need are more doctors like yourself who are familiar with nutrition and are speaking out about gluten. I'm jumping the subject about GMOs and gluten
right.
is a whole other conversation.
Yes, exactly.
And unfortunately, many doctors just don't know enough. When you treat patients, have you ever thought that genetically modified foods were affecting any of them, even though it's kind of hard to know for sure?
Sure. Well, you know, it's my job to maintain what I call and I certainly didn't make this term up, but a holistic mindedness. It is true that medicine and medical physicians can be very, very narrow-minded. And that's, you know, a generalization. It's not true in every case, of course. But the same is also true for holistically minded people, too. I wanted to be very sure that I wasn't simply jumping on the bandwagon and saying that GMOs were bad without good reason. Now, to answer your question, I've been aware of GMO, you know, technologies for a while, ever since back in, I believe it was the 80s, the first GMO supplement, tryptophan, caused several dozen deaths, I believe about 80 deaths of people due to bacterial contamination, it was purported, but more recent evidence that's available through the Freedom of Information Act suggests that those foods, first of all, they definitely were genetically modified. And that looks like that was the issue. And toxic byproducts produced by the genetically modified process cause a condition known as eosinophilia myalgia syndrome. Now, you said something earlier which relates to this. You said, well, how do you, isn't it problemsome to figure out if genetically modified foods are the cause? How can you do that? We're all eating them, et cetera. It's no different than gluten, by the way. But here's one thing. This is why it is difficult. With tryptophan, people develop symptoms very suddenly. They were acute symptoms, and it was easy to link it to tryptophan. And they linked it to all tryptophan on the market, even tryptophan under many different brands, which was confusing at first until they realized only one Japanese manufacturer made all the tryptophan, and they were genetically modifying it. And when they changed the processes, when this problem happened. Now, that was an acute reaction. Assuming for a moment that genetically modified foods are causing problems in human beings over the course of years and decades, which, by the way, is how most problemsome foods cause disease. The genesis of disease is over months to years to decades, so that's not unusual, which is why we use animals, unfortunately, who have shorter lifespans to see things before the scientists themselves are dead.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, because the consumption of GMO over the past 10 or 15 years doesn't have acute toxins, it may have a slow buildup of health problems, makes this a difficult issue, but not an impossible one. There are studies done all the time about problemsome nutrients and all kinds of influences on human health, and that's why we use human studies. We're left with extrapolating most of our information from animal studies, and that was what was done in the French study. And the study had issues, I admit that, just like most scientific studies have issues. And I just find it convenient that when the powers that be want to disavow a study's credibility, they nitpick at problems. Well, if you did that for most studies... This is quoting the American Medical Association themselves, that 80% of procedures and practices in medicine, they don't even have proper studies. And this is what forms medical health care.
Yeah, it's pretty scary, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite scary.
Okay, so what are some of the solutions that you recommend for your patients?
Well, the first thing I think is that people have to be aware of what GMO foods might be if they choose to avoid them. So I'll name some of the foods now if you'd like. And also on my website, I have longer lists and dozens of pages of information on this, a bit more detail. But things like honey and soybeans, virtually all soy is genetically modified. Sugar cane, corn, as I mentioned, genetically modified to produce a pesticide. Canola oil, potatoes, flax, papaya, squash, tobacco. You even have to think of meat because cows are fed genetically modified foods.
Well, most of the soy grown in this country is fed to animals.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But there is organic soy, and we know that that's not genetically modified.
Right. Let's speak about that for a minute. I produce a number of products, as you mentioned. One of them is a health bar that I wanted to have it say genetically, GMO free. So of course I had to look into all these labeling laws, and I found a few things out. First of all, the labeling of products in terms of GMO free or not is a voluntary. By the manufacturer. If I call up the manufacturer of my health bar and I say, I want you to put GMO free on my bar, they're going to do it. And guess what? It may not be GMO free. So this is a huge problem. Now, you say organic. Now, by definition, it's true that if something says organic, it's not supposed to contain something artificially produced like GMO foods. But because of cross-contamination, et cetera, which is problemsome and has been it comes up all the time as an issue, that really a person could never really know. And then you have certain farms that may have a combination of GMO-free and not GMO-free, and they actually have some technology on the farms where they can do testing to see the content of the DNA protein in genetically modified foods. And I'm not so sure I trust the average farmer to be able to interpret that, do it correctly, et cetera, et cetera. My point is there's a lot really based on chance. on the website, on my website, I do distinguish out at least what's purported to be GMO-free. So, for example, if something says 100% organic, it's not supposed to contain GMO. But even 100% organic foods, forget GMO for a minute, doesn't mean that they're fully organic, and they never did. When something is said to be 100% organic, there is a legal limit of a certain amount of chemical pesticide, herbicide, or fungicide that might be in those foods. Maybe it's from the farm next door when they spray, and that's in the air, et cetera, et cetera. We've really created a very, very promising situation. But what can people do? Of course, get educated. Number two, avoid foods that certainly we know are genetically modified, and do our best to choose foods that are not, if we feel so strongly about it. The other thing, too, is that, you know, improving one's overall health and well-being and choosing foods that are not genetically modified, I do believe is the smart thing to do. You know, I have three kids, and, you know, we do not eat genetically modified foods where we can help it.
I taught my
kids that, you know, not to be overly crazy if you go to a friend's house or a party and they have corn or there's some tomatoes or there's something, because I don't want to create too much craziness, but it's balanced with a certain amount of education.
Dr. Wald, we just have a minute left, so I just wanted to ask you, what is your website that you've been referring to?
Sure. The website is www.intmedny.com or blooddetective.com. Both sites will have articles, and you can look up on the blog section for GMO.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for all of your work and what you're doing. We need more people out there fighting this good fight like you. And I just wanted to say that there's in Washington State, they're going to be fighting to get GMO products labeled, and we need to support that in any way we can, because just like in all the other states that have tried to get products labeled, Monsanto and other companies have come in and put a lot of money in to win those fights. So
something
we need to support.
Much.
Thank you so much for joining me, and it's all about food.
You got it.
Have a great day. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to this wonderful program about my favorite subject, food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me emails at info@realmeals.org. And say cool. Have a delicious week.